Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here. My name is Roland Roger, and I'm the Director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute. First, I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today and pay my respects to elders past and present. Today is, of course, my great pleasure to be hosting Professor Ross Garnaut to talk about his new book. Here it is, Superpower: Australia's Low Carbon Opportunity. Professor Garnaut, welcome to the Lowy Institute.
Good to be here. Good to be back.
Just a note for the audience, there will also be an opportunity to purchase the book and get it signed after the formal event. So Ross Garnaut, of course, needs little introduction as one of Australia's foremost economists and public policy intellectuals. And in fact, I was just saying beforehand that I always remember myself as a young economist going to hear Ross talk in 2008 after he just produced the last climate change review, or the review at the time, and finding it one of the most sort of clear-cut explanations of what was going on and how to think about it in policy terms. Just to say a few quick words about Professor Garnaut. Of course, currently he is a professorial research fellow in economics at the University of Melbourne, and among many prominent previous roles was previously the principal economic advisor to former Prime Minister Bob Hawke, as well as an ambassador to China during the late 1980s. Ross was also a founding director on the board of the Lowy Institute as well. And among his many other accomplishments, of course, he led the two previous climate change reviews, first for the Rudd government in 2008 and then for the Gillard government in 2011. And his latest book very much updates on the analysis and arguments that he presented in those reviews, and that's what we'll be discussing today. And just as a quick note to the audience, we'll also be leaving plenty of time after our discussion for Q&A with the audience, so please be ready with your questions at that time as well. So just to begin, in a nutshell, Professor Garnaut, can you tell us, what are the arguments you're making in the book and how have things changed since your last reviews?
So I start the book looking at what's changed in the last dozen years. I was commissioned by all the governments of Australia, state, territory, and federal, in 2007, April 2007, reported to the Premiers and Prime Minister in September 2008. In those days, unimaginable now, not only did it have the support of every corner of our federation, but had the support of the opposition. I was regularly, every couple of weeks, briefing the Leader of the Opposition, Malcolm Turnbull, and his leading front bench members, and everyone was on board. And I tell the story in the book at one point about how a single vote in the Liberal Party room in December 2009 made all of that history, and we've been living with that ever since. I look at in the first chapter, look at first two chapters, changes in four areas, in the science, in the ethics, in the international relations, and the economics of climate change. Briefly, in the science, a lot of good science before and after 2008, and the additional science has reduced uncertainty without changing much average expectations. It has focused more on some of the extreme dangers of going beyond a boundary of about 1.5 or 2 degrees. There's more focus in the science on feedback effects that could be truly catastrophic, and so that is part of the background to the December 2015 Paris meeting agreeing that we should make sure we hold temperature increases to less than 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels and as close as possible to 1.5 degrees. On the very important developments in the ethics of climate change, human ethics arise out of social experience. And this is a problem that's outside our normal experience. So naturally, we took quite a long while as a species to work out the ethical implications. And I touch upon two of the most important contributions. The most important is the authoritative encyclical by Pope Francis, Laudato Si. Francis put together the world's best physicists, well, atmospheric physicists, including a friend of mine, Joachim Schönhuber from the Potsdam Institute near Berlin, and the encyclical's based on the best of contemporary atmospheric physics. And the Pope works through the ethical implications of that and draws very strong conclusions. First of all, appealing to the people in the Christian ethical tradition. One-third of humanity profess Christian belief, also appealing directly through Genesis to the one-quarter of humanity that professes other Abrahamic beliefs, and then appealing to other religious traditions and secular ethical traditions. So it's a universal appeal. Once we know the truth about what science is telling us, there's a very clear ethical implication through all of these traditions. I also mentioned the work of John Broome, Professor of Ethics at Oxford, who caught my attention with his analogy to our private behaviour leading to an emission of a few more tonnes of greenhouse gases being factually akin to firing a rifle into a distant crowd. He draws the strong ethical conclusion that we've got an ethical obligation not only to do what we can to get good government policy to get strong outcomes, but also to offset our private emissions. He says that follows logically from ethical premises that our society accepts in other spheres. Then on the international relations, special interest to this group, my first report, the change between my first and my second report, the first report was based on the idea that this problem was going to require an international agreement of a top-down kind in which there's agreement on the total amount of greenhouse gases that can be allowed into the atmosphere to avoid catastrophic outcomes, and then dividing really permission to emit amongst countries. And a lot of the innovation in my first review, a lot of the international innovation was in this area, and there was a lot of interest in that around the world in that. But that didn't work at Copenhagen at the UN meeting in December 2009, and President Obama really rescued that in that late night meeting that he called with the heads of government of four major developing countries, China, India, South Africa and Brazil. And at the time, I wrote an op-ed in the Financial Review called that the Obama Accord. And I called the new approach concerted unilateral mitigation, which I saw as being analogous to the trade liberalisation that worked in the APEC context, which I called concerted unilateral liberalisation, where each country, where we agree on ultimate objectives, free trade in the case of the Asia-Pacific, holding temperature increases as close as possible to 1.5 degrees in the case of climate, that we make voluntary commitments of our own and then periodically review those and through peer pressure upgrade our commitment, our short and medium-term commitments, so that we asymptote towards the solution. Well, that's worked. The Paris Agreement was a success. Countries actually put much stronger voluntary commitments on the table than they were prepared to put legally binding commitments, and on the whole have met those. We haven't, but nearly every other country has, and we haven't so far, but nearly every other developed country has. China has far exceeded what they put on the table, and that's a big help. That actually makes a strong international outcome possible. Now, we've had a big explosion in the last, since 2017, with the United States seeking to withdraw from the international agreement. That won't upset things if Mr. Trump or someone like him only rules America until the end of next year, but a long-term Trump presidency or long-term presidency of someone like Trump would seriously damage the international framework. So far so good, but risk. But the big changes are in the economics, and here I draw attention mainly to three big things. One is far faster reduction in the cost of renewable energy than I anticipated. My first review, beginning with the support of the state, I had the Victorian and Queensland Treasury and the Centre of Policy Studies, Peter Dixon and Philip Adams group at Monash University, then Victoria now, doing the modelling. And then when it became a Commonwealth State joint exercise, the Federal Treasury joining in, it was the most long-dated, forward-looking modelling of the Australian economy that's ever occurred. And when you do that, you've got to write in presumptions about rates of technological change. And there's one very big error in it. I wrote in an assumption of a few percent per annum reduction in solar energy costs. Well, in the 10 years after that, those costs fell by 85%, transformatively faster reductions in costs than I wrote into my modelling. That's made the cost of the world dealing with the problem much lower, and it's especially advantageous in countries with very rich renewable energy resources. And Australia has decisively, by far, the richest combination of renewable energy resources in the world. We've got a strong position relative to the rest of the world in the old fossil energy economy. Coal and gas, we're the world's biggest coal exporter now. That's from this month, I think, the world's biggest LNG exporter. But our relative strength is much greater in renewable energy. And unlike fossil energy, which is internationally traded now, it didn't used to be, but it is now, you won't get such low transactions costs international trade in renewable energy. It costs a lot to liquefy hydrogen and put it into a ship. It's a really hard element to liquefy. It doesn't liquefy till minus 253 degrees. That's almost absolute zero. Absolute zero is when electrons stop vibrating. That's a huge amount of energy you use to liquefy hydrogen. And then it's, inconveniently, it's the world's smallest molecule, and so it seeps out between the molecules of steel, and so you need special materials to contain it. So it's very expensive to transport it, and you can transport electricity internationally through high voltage transmission cables, but that's expensive too. So whereas for gas, it's no cheaper to use gas in Australia than to use Australian gas in Japan or China. In fact, recently, from time to time, cheaper there. No cheaper, in fact, more expensive to use Australian coal in Western Australia to smelt Australian iron ore than in Kobe in Japan. It's going to be much cheaper to use Australian renewable energy at home. And so we'll be naturally the locus of processing our own raw materials. And I point out in the book that turning one quarter of our iron oxide exports into iron metal, half our aluminium oxide exports into aluminium metal would be far more jobs, employment, export income than coal and LNG together. And that's just the start. I mentioned a dozen other products in which we'll have a very big advantage. So that's a huge change. Second change is reduction in the cost of capital. Mm. And this is something I've been following and writing about in different context for quite a long time. I gave a public lecture at the London School of Economics in 2015 about the new regime of zero costs of capital. I think they are structural changes in the relationship between savings and output and investment and output. It's changed the global savings investment balance. It means that the current the zero average long-term real interest rates for sovereign borrowers in the last decade since the financial crisis are not a short-term phenomenon. They're not driven by unusual monetary policies. They're driven by economic fundamentals. That does two things. It reduces the cost of all new investment, of course, and so reduces the cost of any big transition like the one we have to make. But it systematically reduces the costs of capital-intensive activities more than others. And nearly all of the zero-emissions activities are pure capital. Most of the cost of a gas-based power generator is the cost of the fuel, operating cost. So if you reduce the cost of capital from the long-term historical average of British sovereign bonds since Elizabeth raised the funds to fight the Armada, has been about 5% in real terms, and it's now about zero. And that hugely changes the relative costs of renewable energy and storage and fossil energy. And again, it systematically improves the position of those countries which are strongest internationally in zero emissions energy, which is Australia. And that capital intensity is naturally, it relates to solar and wind, build the equipment, and the running costs are very low, a little bit of maintenance. But very similar for pumped hydro storage, very similar for batteries, very similar for the electric car. Once you buy the car, it won't cost much to run it. In fact, because it's such, the engineering is so much simpler for the electric car, very low maintenance and operating costs compared with the internal combustion engine, with 80 moving parts compared with 1,000 moving parts. So systematically, the structural change in the world economy that's given us lower long-term real interest rates reduces the cost of mitigation. It systematically improves the position of zero emissions energy compared with fossil energy, and strengthens Australia's global position as an energy superpower. Finally, the other thing that's changed is there's much more awareness now of the huge opportunities of storing carbon in soils, woodlands, pastures, forests and plantations. And again, Australia per capita has the world's richest endowment of opportunity of this. I've got a chapter in the book talking about that. So the biggest changes are the economic ones.
That's fascinating. There's so much in this book. Having read through it, I mean, this is just a small snippet of the level of, you know, detail and analysis that's gone in here. So it's absolutely fascinating. And what's the, you know, really great thing about the argument you're putting forward now is that it's become a really positive argument. So yes, there's an element of mitigating and avoiding dangerous global warming, but there's also this argument now that, as you put it, that Australia could be this superpower of the future, low carbon global economy. So I want to sort of ask you, you know, how do we actually get there? And before you answer that, I want to ask you, where are we now in terms of moving there, and why are we where we are in your view?
Well, we're sort of like the grand old Duke of York at the moment. Those are the back crying forward, those are the forward crying back, and some of the forward going forwards and back. Both the public discussion and the business discussion and the government policy, especially the federal level, is incoherent. It creates a problem for transition. What I say in the book is that there's a lot that can be done consistently without violating explicit electoral undertakings of the current federal government. And so I say, let's concentrate on those things. For all the reasons economists understand very well, it would be environmentally and economically much more efficient to have a general carbon price, as we had very successfully for 2 years. But that doesn't work if you don't have a high degree of confidence that it will continue, and if you've got partisan opposition or division over the issue, you won't get the investment as a result of that. So it's not worth thinking about in the current state of policy discussion. But I do mention a few things that can be done to help things get started. I have to go to the book to see the detail, but our recommendation 4 of the ACCC about a sovereign underwriting of certain types of long-term investment, I think would be important. I don't think that violates any current government's electoral commitments. I think that we're going... I talk about how if we do this right, within a decade or so, we'll need an electricity system about 3 times as big as the current one, and then it'll keep growing from then. So it's not a matter of decarbonising our existing system. It's having a zero-emission system that's many times bigger than the current system. And the regulatory frameworks we work within make incremental change very difficult and slow. So I'm saying that the big changes are going to have to be driven by private, unregulated initiative, but you could help that along quite a lot by at the points of interaction between the new private, unregulated transmission system and the high-cost, privatised, regulated system that's moved us from being one of the lowest-cost transmission countries in the world 20 years ago to the highest-cost in the developed world today. where the new system improves the efficiency, lowers the cost, or improves the reliability of the old system, give some credit for that. That will help the new one grow, especially in the early stages. And I also make a suggestion for reliability in the established system through use of Snowy 2.0. It's probably a relatively high-cost way of balancing renewable energy. But if we're going to do it anyway, let's make good use of it and make some suggestions for making good use of it.
I mean, I like that you focus on, you know, incremental sort of targeted policy measures that work within the existing policy framework that the government is operating with. But is that really going to be enough to put us where we need to be? And, you know, and if it's not, or even to the extent that it is, you know, how, in your view, you know, how, what kind of window do we have before we really need to start moving towards something more ambitious? I know you're putting aside the carbon price, right? So all the economists always say, and, you know, we need, what you want is a broad-based carbon price so that it gets internalized into market transactions. Then you have all of these changes sweeping across the whole economy. That's the most efficient way and most powerful way. But if you're putting it, if it's not now, when will it be that we need to move to that? I mean, how long do we have to dither and play politics? Really?
Well, I hope that parts of the private sector, and it'll be the new private sector, because the old private sector in the energy sector, energy using sector, does very well out of the current oligopolistic arrangements. And so you can't expect big innovation. Disruption and introduced reduction of low cost model is unattractive to incumbents. So that's why, in almost any industry, although there's studies at Harvard Business School, and there's a book on it, how it's never the incumbents who lead innovation, even though one would think they were in the best position to do it. And there's complex reasons for that, but the simple explanation is that they've got so much to lose through disruption of the existing oligopoly. So it'll be new companies, so we've got to be open to new, including foreign, but also transformative domestic investment. And that can start happening now. And when there's a chance of it happening, and those three innovations that I mentioned, especially the first two, can be quite helpful to that. I express the view in the book that the policy environment will be changed by early success. If we continue with the current coal-based energy system, then we'll see the closure of the big aluminium smelters in Portland, Victoria, Tomago near Newcastle in New South Wales, Gladstone in Queensland over the next decade, some sooner, some later. If we start putting in place new energy systems, and they will all expand. Early success will transform what's politically possible. And that's when you can start talking about bigger policy change, I think. I spent the last few days up in central Queensland. I've been going pretty regularly since my early work to the nodes of regional and provincial Australia that are most anxious about the structural change. It just happens that they've got huge opportunities in the new economy. They're very excited about the new economy. The sad little town of Alpha between Rockhampton and Park Alden in central Queensland. I was there yesterday, and no young people in the town anymore. Old people just sit on their verandas and look. And their big hope is that Clive Palmer and Gina Rinehart will build them a new coal mine, and there'll be lots of jobs, and so their grandkids will come home and all that sort of stuff. It's a poignant story. I spent a fair bit of time talking to them. But in that region, I've been talking about the new opportunities, and they are real, they're big, and they want jobs. They would love new sustainable jobs, but they want jobs, and so demonstrating through things that are actually happening, the new economy makes the case for a different policy framework. Now, one area in which trade in carbon credits is going to be very important is the land sector. And Australia's opportunity in this area are immense. We've got by far the world's biggest endowment per capita of woodland. And one fact that I've come across over the last year or so, courtesy of colleagues in the sciences at Melbourne University, there's more carbon in the top 2 metres of land on Earth than in the whole of the atmosphere and the whole of the biosphere. Mm. So relatively small augmentation of the carbon content of soils can have a transformative effect. Similarly, woodlands. Per capita, we've got by far the richest endowment of woodlands. Woodlands which don't compete with high-value agriculture for land. I've spent a fair bit of time with the leaders of the Indigenous Business Australia recently. They came to me, like all of these councils in regional Australia did, they came to me to talk about what future they might have. Well, and the land groups, land councils associated with Indigenous Business Australia have responsibility for over 1 million square kilometres of land. Most of this land is in that semi-arid country with huge opportunity for accruing carbon in landscape. There's no part of Australia where, with different management of the land, you couldn't accrue a tonne and a hectare of carbon in woodlands. That's just part of the story, keeping up feral animals and so on. Well, a million square kilometres, 100 million hectares. Carbon is trading in the European market today at $40 a tonne. That's $4 billion a year just on that indigenous managed land. But you need to be in an international trading system to do that. So I suggest a three-stage process. During the term of this parliament, spend all of the $2 billion that Mr. Morrison promised to spend on the Climate Solutions Fund on this for this 3 years. He said spend it by 2030. Well, it's not a violation of electoral commitment to make it available as soon as the credits are certified by the Clean Energy Regulator. And if that happens to be all in 3 years, well and good. Then I've suggested through the 2020s, require offsetting of all fugitive emissions from LNG production and coal mining. Now, why emissions are rising in Australia uniquely amongst developed countries in recent years is our fugitive emissions from coal mining and gas liquefaction, or production and liquefaction. Require the offsetting of that and allow, as one form of offsetting, the purchase of credits certified by the Clean Energy Regulator from Australian land. Well, that starts to give you a decent market. That's a lot of money, and that lot more than in Mr. Morrison's $2 billion. And then by the end of the 2020s, by then, hopefully, we'll have done enough to have qualified for trade with the European Union, which will create a very much larger market. So I see a staged process that can make good headway now without any violation of the current government's electoral commitments.
And one of the biggest difficulties, of course, is the degree of international cooperation required in order to deal with this problem. But, you know, setting that aside for a second, I mean, the idea of Australia being this low-carbon superpower, what degree of international cooperation do we need there? Is that linkage just to the EU mechanism? Is that largely enough to facilitate a lot of this occurring, or do we still need something much more global in scale, you know, bringing in China and the United States, for example?
Well, we need everyone to honour their commitments of Paris, which means heading towards a zero emissions economy by 2050 for the world as a whole, earlier for developed countries. We need that. And we need an open international trading system. They're the two building blocks.
For emissions, for credits.
No. Open international trading system, full stop.
Full stop.
I chair an organisation set up by Angela Merkel and Malcolm Turnbull called the Australian-German Energy Transition Hub, where we've got cooperation between German and Australian research institutes working on energy transition, but also business, energy users and energy producers, also government. The main European countries have strongly committed to this transition. I've spent a fair bit of time with German steelmakers. They are presuming the policy will require them to have zero emission steel sometime in the next couple of decades. They recognise, partly through interaction with us, but they recognise that the cheapest way for them to do it is to turn Australian iron oxide into iron metal, and then do the later stages of processing, make a lot of the higher value products and the Mercedes-Benz in Germany. Now, you need open trade for that. And if we get a complete breakdown of the global open trading system, and I regret that that is under threat at the moment, let's not kid ourselves, that's under threat. If the global trading system breaks down, then all international cooperation that depends on trade will break down, and we won't do so well in that world.
Yeah. So if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting a fair bit can actually happen through, in a sense, the market, as long as you allow the market to operate. And it's partly because they are, in fact, anticipating policy will come along at some point in time, and you don't want stranded assets and uneconomic business models and so on. And that's part of the sort of hope of how this can work. But I just want to bring you to this question of trade, of course. And what is the role of China in all of this? Of course, you know, we know that China's emissions have started to tick up again more recently, and that's related to, you know, not entirely, I would argue, to the trade war, but it is related to some of the pressures that they're facing on their economy. But on the other hand, of course, you know, China has also been very important, right, for the reduction in the equipment costs for renewable energy. And at the same time, we hear China being criticized for its industrial policies. You know, I think the first salvo from the Trump administration on trade actually targeted cheap Chinese solar panels, in fact, for being unfairly subsidized. How do you sort of reconcile the role that China is playing in all of this between, you know, rising emissions on the one hand, but also actually being, you know, an important source of cheap solar panels, basically, it's seemingly achieved through this kind of industrial policies?
Well, I'm an unashamed supporter of globalization. And I think what's happened in renewable energy is one of the great success stories of globalization. Three elements were most important. European policies early in this century created a market for solar panels. We opened up our education system to international fee-paying students in 1986. Yeah, young people here, not many of us, remember that before 1986, before that Hawke government initiative, it was illegal for an Australian university to take a fee-paying student from abroad. So the second step in globalisation that made the global energy transition possible was Australian education policy allowing foreign students. Third one, a lot of very clever kids from China did electrical engineering degrees at Australian universities, some at my two alma mater, ANU and Melbourne, but I'm honest enough to say that the most important centre is the University of New South Wales Electrical Engineering School. And kids with that training, bright young kids, introduced to the frontier of the science, went back to China at exactly the time the European market was opening up for solar panels induced by climate policies. Most importantly, Germany, but also Britain, France, and the European Union as a whole, and form companies to take advantage of that. Three of the first five big Chinese successful private companies that created the solar photovoltaic industry had their education at the University of New South Wales. They brought China's incomparable capacity to reduce manufacturing costs, and that's not just labour costs. Labour costs are no longer low in China compared with most of the developing world, but they're good at it. And I've been following one of those solar companies for 11 years because I was interested in progress. And the reduction of costs has come from 100 little things, using a bit less copper in the wire, a bit less each year, and all these small improvements that add up to a transformational change. And then it reached a point where the scale was, Europe was the early market for photovoltaics, but once scale became big enough, costs came down, became competitive in China, and the big growth industry and the big growth market has been China. And so China's now by far the world's biggest market for photovoltaic panels. It became a virtuous circle. Costs have kept coming down and made supply of zero emissions energy in Australia globally competitive. And created a basis for new minerals exporting industries in Australia. There's no bit of that story that I'm at all uncomfortable with. Mr. Trump's trying to blow that type of story up. I think the future of global democracy and the future of global development depends on Mr. Trump failing in his attempts to blow up the global trading system.
That's a good point to a very good point to segue to the Q&A with the audience. A lot of things to pick up on there, no doubt. But that's definitely an interesting element of the story. So we'll now go to questions from the audience. The usual rules apply. Just please state your name, any affiliation. Please wait for the microphone, and of course, please keep it to a question and not a comment. We'll just go to this lady at the front here first.
Thank you, Professor Garno, India Mason-Cox. In an article in the Australian Financial Review on Monday, Alexander Downer opined that increasing electricity costs to address climate change would be rejected by the public as expensive virtue signalling. We then hear about Sweden dumping Australian bonds due to Australia's inaction on climate change because of the risk associated with our interests being tied up in fossil industries, among other things. It would seem that some of the commentators informing the debate are out of touch in terms of strategising to address climate change. Do you think Sweden's move will be replicated by other countries? And do you think Sweden's action will have any significant effect on our economy?
I think that comment about the links between renewable energy and costs of power is out of touch. Sometimes these things take hold, but I would be a little bit surprised if that action by a couple of Scandinavian countries becomes more general. We'll wait and see. It's been more powerful in funding of business than in funding of governments. This is the first action of which I'm aware directed at governments who other governments think are not acting satisfactorily on climate change. I'd be surprised if that becomes very important in the discrimination against countries like Australia in sovereign bond markets. I'd be surprised if that becomes very important. Some other things will become important. Already, the campaigns against equities in companies that or lending to companies that are associated with unsatisfactory approaches to emissions have been important. And in my discussions with the Germans, I've been quite interested to see that there's now a view in European industry that it's just a matter of time before you get border taxes related to carbon. And the point that's been made to me, If you know my history, I was in the front line of all the free trade discussions, reform discussions of the 60s, 70s and 80s, and so I'm the last person in the world to be at all comfortable about introducing new barriers to international trade. But for a long time, it did seem that the rules of the WTO were going to be a barrier to carbon taxes against imports from countries that had, from the point of view of the importing country, unsatisfactory climate policies. But the view that I've heard in these discussions with Europeans recently is that they think that the inhibitions about that are being removed by Donald Trump. That what would once have been a constraint on carbon taxes at the border, it's a very small constraint compared with what the US president is doing, so that's no inhibition, and German industry, European industry likes it. So We may find the border taxes related to carbon become more important in international trade.
Silver lining there for the Trump administration. We'll go to this gentleman at the front, please.
Thank you. Brian Everingham, Institute for International Affairs. I'm hearing, even on the Council of Foreign Relations websites and all their podcasts, that a number of insurance companies are discovering that these events, these, quote, unexplained, inexplicably difficult events, are now uninsurable. Is that is likely to be a trend that is likely to drive further change?
Yes, and even when I was doing my original work in 2007, 2008, the one part of the Australian business sector that was prepared to accept the science was the insurance sector. I had a lot of support. Some of the big insurers in Australia, including international insurers, had bought the services of the top modellers of atmospheric physics in Australia and abroad to try to get a handle on this. So the people whose livelihoods were at risk were taking it very seriously then. So that's not a change. What has changed is that the extreme events have started to occur. Already in some regions you can't insure at least other than at astronomic costs against certain types of risk. And climate risks are particularly difficult ones because insurance works through the balancing of uncorrelated risks. But these are correlated risks. If Brighton goes underwater in Melbourne, Manly will go underwater at about the same time. And that's really hard for an insurance company. We will see a contraction of insurance markets. Some of the European insurers, and they're the big global insurers, have become very sophisticated in management of climate risk and at balancing offsetting risks. And while a lot of the general risks are closely correlated, risks from climate change, some of the particular risks are not correlated, and so they're searching for uncorrelated risks that they can use to support insurance.
Ross, Harley Wright, a scientist and manager, very concerned about climate change since I first learned about it in 1979. If I can take you back to Kyoto in 1997 and ask about the approach there which was being fostered when the Annex B countries signed up to reduce their emissions. There were about 37 countries and they agreed on a limit to their overall emissions of 5.2%, and that sort of went ahead. The USA pulled out of it. But what has happened to that approach where then the rich countries agreed to sign up to Kyoto and it was expected that it would the trading would work well and the poor countries would come in and there'd be international trade between the poor countries and the rich countries of emissions permits. In other words, a top-down allocation of emission quotas based on the what we now call the carbon budget, how much we can safely put into the atmosphere. What's happened to that approach? Yeah.
Thanks, Harley. And for other people present, Harley's been following this issue closely and corresponding with me on it since my first report in 2008, and thanks for the staunchness in following the issues, Harley. Yeah, the Kyoto approach was to for the international community to agree on the budget for emissions that could safely be put into the atmosphere, and then allocate that on an equitable basis amongst countries. And the Kyoto agreement said that most of the historical emissions in the atmosphere, the increase in emissions, were from the developed countries. So developed countries should move first. And once they've made some progress after 2012, developing countries would come in. I pointed out in my 2008 report that wouldn't solve the problem because, mainly because one developing country, China, was so big that unless it was part of the constraints from the beginning, although it might not be international justice because lots of other countries had higher per capita emissions and higher incomes than China, it was just necessary for China to be part of it or the arithmetic wouldn't add up. So I developed there an approach that I described as modified contraction and convergence, where each developed country would reduce its emissions in a linear way to a zero point agreed by international discussion. Today you'd make it, say, 2040. And developing countries would constrain the emissions intensity of their economies until their per capita emissions were as high as the average for developed countries, and then they would go down on the same linear path. And I thought, well, what I argued in 2008 is to be acceptable, it's got to be seen as being fair internationally, and I thought that had a fair chance. That was much discussed. I was invited by the State Council in China and National Development Research Center to discuss that in Beijing. I had discussions in India and received a fair bit of support in India. So I think it did have legs. China really relates to the bit of the question I didn't answer on China in the international system. China always insisted that it was a developing country, but in the context of the Obama Accord, said that it, unlike other developing countries, it would accept absolute constraints on emissions. So it said we're doing this voluntarily. We're not required to. We're a developing country, but we'll live by those rules. And it actually has lived by those rules since then. Now, in the story I told of the movement from the Kyoto approach to the post-Copenhagen approach agreed in Paris, let's call them Kyoto and Paris, the Paris Agreement is not based on a top-down approach, it's everyone making their voluntary commitments. That still has to be guided by some principles. And so I think the sorts of principles of modified contraction convergence are still relevant to guiding outcomes. And I've noticed that quite a lot of agencies around the world are doing that. When the Carbon Change Authority, the Climate Change Authority in Australia, which has statutory responsibility for setting targets, which become the law unless both the House of Reps and the Senate overrules them, which Mr. Abbott tried to repeal, but that public-spirited Senator Clive Palmer got blocked its repeal after his discussions with Al Gore in 2015. The Climate Change Authority took my modified contraction and convergence and defined an Australian emissions reduction path based on that. So I think it's good to still use that as guidance, but we're no longer trying to have a legally binding international agreement. Now, it's hugely beneficial in terms of the cost of reaching zero emissions, hugely beneficial in the pathway to that if we can trade internationally carbon permits in the meantime. And for international trade, you have to have countries involved in trade accepting that each is doing something reasonable. And so you can't have Australia saying, well, we're only going to reduce emissions by 28%, so if we reduce them more than that, we'll sell credits. That won't be acceptable unless what we're doing is seen in an international context to be reasonable. And I think those principles of modified contraction and convergence are relevant to defining those principles.
Now, can I ask you, Ross, what about investments by advanced countries in developing countries to try and help with this transition and bring down emissions in that kind of way, right? Particularly because they don't have the same sort of infrastructure necessarily that's built around a carbon-intensive economy. I'm thinking of things like the Green Climate Fund and the work the World Bank does. I'm not sure if you address that necessarily in the book. Do you see that as a central element? Do you think that's something also that we should be doing more of? I note that even the Australian government is now just commissioning a review of what kind of overseas assistance we provide into middle-income countries. This could be a part of that. Do you think that's important?
Yes, I do think it's important. Well, I came to climate change late. I spent the first four-fifths of my career on international economics in general. So I can't help thinking a lot about global development and global trade when I'm thinking about this issue. We should be providing a lot more support of that kind for good reasons of global development, independently of climate. But it's particularly important in the energy transition because a lot of the investment that's necessary involves major infrastructure investments, and they're very difficult to finance for a developing country without international credit standing, without a strong private sector, and so I think international support of that's important. I don't think it's not important in China. It's probably not very important in India, which has got a very big solar and other renewable energy program. It's got big companies itself, a lot of sovereign borrowing capacity. Although I must say that when under the Obama administration, Secretary for State Kelly made these sorts of programs to India a very important part of US foreign policy, and it did help in the Indian story. Mm-hmm. But certainly for poorer developing countries, the whole of Africa, where the global development story is concentrated today, international public support is very important. In this context, I think our response to Belt and Road should be not to try to stop it, but to do something even better ourselves. And a little bit of that started to happen has started to happen. China's been very active in Africa. For those who follow these things, Ethiopia has had which is the second most populous country in Africa, more people than any country in Europe. So it's not an insignificant country. It's had the highest average growth rate in the world in the 21st century after being a real misery case in the 20th century. Our Chinese infrastructure investments have been very important in that, especially in the energy sector, but also other infrastructure. Partly in response to Chinese influence in Africa, Obama was able to get the U.S. Congress to pull back on abolishing the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which had provided loans for U.S. firms to provide similar activities. So the American response was a positive one then. Whether that will survive the current pullback from globalization in the United States, we'll have to wait and see, but there are economic, climate and geostrategic implications if they do. In our region, one response to China's Asian Infrastructure Investment Fund was Japan hugely increased its funding to the Asian Development Bank for infrastructure of a similar kind, so that to make the ADB as big as the new infrastructure fund in China. That's the sort of global competition that can help. For us, we can be especially useful in our own region, in the South Pacific and Southeast Asia. I think that if we use well the shift to greater awareness of the geostrategic importance to us of successful development in our region, then that's a good way for us to go.
Hi, Professor. My name's Sam Muckford. I'm from Deloitte's Energy Transition Team. You mentioned, or you were just talking about infrastructure just then, a big impediment that we're seeing to further integration of renewables into the grid here in Australia is obviously infrastructure investment in transmission and distribution. Generators these days, their revenues are getting cut quite dramatically by lower marginal loss factors, especially announced by AEMO at the start of this year. I'd be interested to hear your perspectives on whether actions that are taken by federal and state governments today to increase investment into that kind of infrastructure, whether that is sufficient or and what else could be done?
Australians are going to be surprised over the next little while. We've got a real train wreck in the renewable energy sector as a result of the inadequacy of high voltage transmission from the good renewable energy regions. Predictable train wreck. I said in 2008 that was going to be a challenge, and I set out a number of things that we had to do to avoid it, and we didn't do them. It's a very big issue. I'm not optimistic about the regulated system being able to handle it. For those of us who ever taught second-year microeconomics, who taught it after 1962, the standard text was an American Economic Review article in 62 that said if you've got a natural monopoly, you have to regulate price, and you must never regulate it by reference to rate of return. Well, we regulate by reference to rate of return, and as a result, we went from in 20 years from being the country with just about the lowest transmission costs to the country with just about the highest transmission costs, exactly as that AER article in 1962, A. Version Johnson said we would. I don't think we read the AER any more carefully now than we did in 2006 when the silly system was put in place. So that's why I think that we'll build the foundations for the superpower through private, unregulated initiative. And what we have to do is make sure we make that easier rather than harder.
Hi, I'm Sarosh Patliwala. I appreciate the thesis that you're presenting today about all the opportunities, and I think it's a very important message and a positive message given this global circumstance. But my question is, even though there's great technological improvement and opportunity and the cost curve is rapidly declining, can it still be too late? And the context I give is we know that climate change has been in the public awareness certainly at least 30 years, possibly 40 years for those who are very astute, but let's say 30 years. We know from the IPCC that we've got 25 to 35 years on a best estimate or average scenario to get down to net zero. There's a risk that it might need to be faster. And yet emissions have still been rising. So I don't want to detract from the importance of your message, but I'd like to get your assessment of, is it too late without some coordinated, concerted, aggressive political action?
Well, it's not too late. Well, it is too late to avoid very substantial problems because we've already got them. I flew from central Queensland to Brisbane and then to Sydney yesterday afternoon. A smoke haze over that whole area and couldn't see through it in the last 100 kilometres into Brisbane. Well, that hasn't happened before. I start the book with the story of Jane and my travels up the Darling River in August. The Darling River, which was once one of the great waterways carrying wool and copper ore from northwestern New South Wales down to ports in South Australia, is dry. Great big Murray River cod that survived 80 summers and a dozen droughts, that's being dragged out of their shrinking, stagnant water holes by wild pigs and killed off. So it's too late to stop those things. But there isn't a single point of it being too late. There are a whole lot of tipping points. Really, this is the moral story of firing a rifle into a crowd. Every little bit does some damage. There's a certain threshold at which, beyond which it's unreasonable to expect survival of stable political systems in South Asia or Southeast Asia. We're short of that. No matter how far along the track we are, until we've got the sort of disorder in which coherent policy is no longer possible, and we're not there yet, there's no point along the track until we get to that point where it's too late to do what we can. I use the expression several times in the book that, when seeking to answer the question, how fast will this happen in Australia? And I say, gradually, then suddenly. And the suddenness will come in Australia will come from two things. First, realisation of the extent of the opportunity. Now, Australians, and we're probably not very different from most humans, but as Australians don't believe anything until they actually see it in front of them. If they hear of it being done in Germany or California, they might as well be on Mars. But if they see it happening in Western Sydney or Gladstone, then it becomes real. So gradually, until Australians see what can be done to increase our prosperity while we rapidly deal with climate change, and also suddenly as the accumulation of evidence of the damage of climate change becomes overwhelming. Will the current disruption of climate, the bushfires, the drought, be enough? Probably not. But the accumulation of such things and more severe such things will shrink denial down to the irreducible minimum of denial. There's always 10% of humanity that will deny science on anything where the science is leading to an inconvenient outcome. A brilliant lecture on this by Peter Doherty at the Medicine Nobel Laureate at the University of Melbourne on the phenomenon of denial, and he put climate change denial in the same category as denial of immunisation. No matter what happens, there's 10% of Australians and South Africans who don't believe that immunisation works. There's 10% who don't believe that certain sexual behaviour leads to HIV, AIDS. We're just about down to that. The Lowy poll says, I talk about this a bit in the book, but seems to suggest that on climate change we're back to that irreducible minimum. There'll always be a Barnaby Joyce and a Tony Abbott on any scientific issue, we're almost down to that on the climate issue. So I think gradually then suddenly.
Unfortunately, that's all we've reached the sort of end point for our discussion. I know there's one more question, and maybe we can talk about that after the formal event. Would everyone just please join me in thanking Ross Garnaut?